This is the Down East Journal on Public Radio East. This week, Boeing Company was involved with a successful ballistic missile test over the Pacific Ocean. The missile intercept system was designed to detect a missile in flight and use an interceptor vehicle to collide with the missile before it reached its target. Did you know that the technology that makes today's missile defense systems possible was first developed on Topsail Island more than 70 years ago? Tucked away on the south end of the 26-mile-long Barrier Island is a museum that tells the story of Topsail Island, from the Native Americans who called it home, pirates who plundered merchant ships off the coast, to Camp Davis, a former anti-aircraft base in Holly Ridge. One of the more unusual items on display is part of a barnacle-crusted spent solid fuel rocket in a 5-foot glass aquarium.
This missile was found by a young couple that were walking the beach, and it was in 1995. It's the booster part of a rocket and where the fuel is.
Director of the Missiles and More Museum, Rose Peters, says it dates back to the Cold War era when Topsail Island was undeveloped and the government used the island as a proving ground for some of the first United States missile efforts.
Operation Bumblebee was highly classified. It started on the island in 1946, and they were only here 2 years, 1946 to 48. The two components of Operation Bumblebee, the military part was the Navy, the civilian part was John Hopkins Applied Physics Lab in Laurel, Maryland.
Unlike initial missile testing sites in New Jersey and Delaware, Topsail's remoteness and expansiveness made it ideal for developing experimental ramjet propulsion systems for supersonic missiles. In March 1947, it became the permanent facility for testing Cobra and Stovepipe missiles, ranging up to 13 feet in length. More than 580 Navy, Marine Corps, and scientists were assigned to Operation Bumblebee. A concrete launch pad was constructed, along with a control tower, a bomb-proof shelter, and 8 observation towers, some of which are still standing today. Another facility was constructed to build and store the rockets. It's now the location of the Missiles and More Museum.
They built the building that we are standing in right now. That's called the Assembly Building. The purpose of the building was actually to assemble the missiles from start to finish, and that's including putting fuel in the missile and anything else that was needed.
The Assembly Building was reinforced with 10-inch thick concrete walls extending 5 feet above the interior floor of the structure. That way, if there was an explosion, the force of the blast would be contained within the building and directed up, not out.
We also have exposed copper electrodes in the building, which were used to bleed off any static electricity that may be in the building, because, again, there's live fuel in this building. And we've exposed 4 of them during a renovation. However, there are 64 of those copper electrodes in this building.
There were also 4 lightning rods in each corner of the assembly building, a preventative measure for a very delicate operation.
When the missile was assembled, they would take it out to the porch. There is a porch, which is still existing, on the building. And they would have a crude wooden crate. They would put the missile on the crate and take it across the street to the launching pad.
Then they were loaded into rocket launchers built from wood and steel that cradled the missile on a frame aimed toward the north end of the island. The first missiles were launched in the fall of 1946. During these tests, scientists and technicians viewed the launches up close from inside the bomb-proof shelter through a 4-inch by 3-foot window. At the same time, members of the Johns Hopkins University Applied Physics Laboratory photographed the event from atop observation towers positioned along the entire length of the island.
They were doing different testing. The main testing was mileage, how much distance they could get out of a missile. There was never a target. They were never aimed at a target. Once they took off, they would do a distance, velocity, various tests that they were doing. Once the missile did its distance, majority of them go into the ocean.
The last missile firing occurred on November 15, 1947. During Operation Bumblebee, more than 200 missiles launched. After the 18-month project, Peter says the data went to other research facilities across the country.
Cape Canaveral, which is now the Kennedy Space Center. It also went to White Sands, New Mexico, and Death Valley in California. So a lot of the data applied to more testing that was going on. So we're very, very proud of this was one of the first.
30 years after the program ended, a Johns Hopkins staff member, Irving B. Irving, stated in an interview that Operation Bumblebee produced vital information on guidance systems, aerodynamics, solid propellants, booster configurations, and other related scientific data. It's their research on ramjet rockets collected on Topsail Island that eventually led to the development of more sophisticated tactical missiles, like the Talos, on display near the entrance to the Missiles and More Museum.
That was not assembled in this building. However, all the data that they collected from their studies here applied to the Talos. The Talos, the Terrier, and the Tartar missiles were used on carrier ships, which they needed more than 26 miles testing. But they did learn a lot from the data that was collected here.
Over the past 70 years, the landscape of Topsail Beach has changed significantly from an uninhabited barrier island to a popular summer vacation spot. The largest artifacts from Topsail's missile history is the remaining 8 concrete observation towers, most of them repurposed as beach homes. Some are listed on the National Register of Historic Places. Peter says new artifacts are still being recovered from time to time, as bits and pieces of rockets have been found washed up along Topsail Island. One such item is on display at the museum, a metal cone-shaped piece that's about 15 inches long from a Cobra missile recovered after Hurricane Fran. The 75-foot by 100-foot launching platform now serves as part of the patio for the Jolly Roger Inn, 3 blocks away from the museum. The Missiles and More Museum is open Monday through Saturday from 2 to 5. If you'd like to see a slideshow of photos from Operation Bumblebee and my trip to the museum, go to our website, publicradioeast.org. This is the Down East Journal on Public Radio East. I'm Jared Brumbaugh.
The deadline for our year-long goal in fully funding Public Radio East is almost here. June 30th is the last day of Public Radio East fiscal year. If you've never made a pledge before, decide what you'd like to contribute and make a pledge in any amount at publicradioeast.org. Our goal is to raise $60,000 before the end of June. We'll be counting that down. With your help, we'll make our year-long goal, our end of fiscal year goal here at Public Radio East.
This week on American Roots, we'll remember the late singer-songwriter Jesse Winchester through his music and his own words. Then a visit to Rugby, Virginia for a close listen to sustainable guitars and ukuleles made by Jane and Wayne Henderson. I'm Nick Spitzer. Join me for American Roots from PRX.
American Roots this evening at 6 o'clock on all of the PRE Public Radio East stations. Grab your binoculars. The North Carolina Coastal Federation is offering a birding trip this Sunday where you can explore the North River Wetlands Preserve with some of the most experienced birders on the coast. They'll share their knowledge on local birds who use the preserve as habitat or as a natural resting stop. You'll also learn more about the successful wetland restoration project, one of the largest in North Carolina and among the largest of its kind in the nation. Today, Mac McKee speaks with Coastal Education Coordinator for the North Carolina Coastal Federation, Rachel Bassessi.
Out of about 6,000 acres of natural habitat at the North River Preserve, how much do you basically explore in a single trip, and how long is the trip itself?
Sure. So the North River Wetlands Preserve, like you said, is about 6,000 acres of farmland that the Federation has been working with different partners to restore back into wetlands since 1999. And the trip, the bird tour, it doesn't cover the entire 6,000 acres. But what we do is we meet people at the gate and then we carpool around to different hot spots for birds. And it takes about 3 hours. It's from 8 a.m. to 11 a.m.
And what kind of bird life or waterfowl can a participant be expected to see this time of year?
So we will see great blue herons, ibis, marsh hawks, bluebirds, different types of sparrows. There's a variety of waterfowl that we see out there as well.
Now, how many total birding trips will be offered throughout the summer and the year as well?
This is our second birding tour of the year. We had one in February, and we're just kind of testing them out for now. So this is the second one, and we don't have any more scheduled at this time, but we're hoping to schedule some throughout next fall and then into the winter. But we do have some other cruise programs this summer at Hammocks Beach State Park where you can look for birds as well.
Now, the trip that we're talking about happens this Sunday, this coming weekend. How many spots do you have available for it?
We currently have 12 spots remaining, and that is out of 15.
What do you hope that participants overall will gain from this trip?
The participants will learn a little bit about the wetland restoration site, where they are, the different restoration projects that the Coastal Federation has been working to do out there at the preserve. And then we hope they'll be able to see a variety of wildlife. There's other animals on the site other than just birds, although there have been over 240 different bird species recorded at the preserve.
Is this trip appropriate for both adults and children, or mainly just maybe older children?
So all ages are welcome, but the program is mainly geared towards adults and older children.
And what do the participants need to bring for this 3 hours? It sounds like it could get a little strenuous even just by driving.
So we ask them to bring their own binoculars, although we'll have some there as well if they don't have any. And then we ask them to bring some water and a snack.
About what time do you have to meet, and where is the meeting place to get started on Sunday?
So North River Wetlands Preserve is in Otway, and we have people meet right outside of the gate at 7:45 a.m.
Rachel, of course, you are the Coastal Educational Coordinator for the North Carolina Coastal Federation. Thanks a lot for speaking with me today.
Thank you so much, Max.
For more information on this tour, you can visit the ENC events calendar at publicradioeast.org, or you can call the North Carolina Coastal Federation at 252-393-8185.
This is the Down East Journal. The passing of Memorial Day also marks the unofficial start of the summer travel season, which around here means traveling east for time at the beach. A time-honored tradition of those beach visits is something called the beach read, something good but not too heavy, right in the wheelhouse of the murder mystery. A novel by a Raleigh author and one-time Jacksonville newspaper reporter fits that bill, introducing a new character investigating murderous going-ons at her old stomping ground. George Olson has this, which aired in April 2014.
In 1993, N.P. Simpson published a book about a 1981 triple homicide at Camp Lejeune that to this day is unresolved.
Now, the perception was that the person who did it just got off on a technicality, but that's not true. That's not the case at all. But at the same time, I think that gives it an unsatisfying edge. I can't supply another ending to this because this is real life. Real life is a continuum.
Simpson says that was a problem with her book, Tunnel Vision. Readers don't want to feel that a murderer somehow escaped punishment or was rewarded, and that's why she believes fictional murder mysteries are so popular with the reading public.
In these murder mysteries, you're dealing with very profound events. I mean, the greatest event that can happen would be the loss of a life, but it's nobody you're related to and it's nobody you know. They're fictional characters, and I think that allows you to confront this, but at the same time to distance yourself from it. In the same way, I don't want to be a homicide detective. I'm glad we have them, but frankly, I don't think I could deal with it. But at the same time, to read about it and take just a little bit of their life is rewarding and it's exciting.
Thus, N.P. Simpson, 20 years after her first nonfiction book publication, takes on the world of a fictional investigator and the first of what she hopes will be a series starring Naval Criminal Investigative Service agent Fran Setliff. Her first Fran Setliff novel is entitled B.O.Q. and is set at Camp Lejeune, an area she is familiar with as a then-wife to a Marine based at Lejeune and as a former reporter for the base's Globe newspaper and then for the Jacksonville Daily News. That familiarity is just part of the reason for basing the book at Camp Lejeune.
It's an interesting cast of characters, and let me put three quick things that are unique about a military community. First thing, everybody who lives there is young. Second thing, everybody who lives there is fit. It is unusual to see an obese person on a Marine Corps base. Fitness is their mania. Fitness is part of their job description. They're actually tested on it. That's different than what you see in the civilian world. And the third thing is, everybody that you see there has a sense of purpose, has a job that has a good opportunity for promotion. Every kid in the school has at least one parent who's employed in a job that has an opportunity for promotion. I mean, that's not true of many communities. That almost sounds like, you know, Stepford Wives. It sounds so. I mean, there are definitely difficulties. I'm not playing down that there are negatives that you have to accept, but at the same time, it's unique. It has a vibe that's different because of it.
But the uniqueness of military life gave Simpson pause about how relatable a book involving military culture would be, given a growing gap between civilians and the military as the percentage of Americans who served dwindles. Her concern was those unfamiliar with the military might have a hard time identifying with its culture.
Then I tell myself, you're worried about Camp Lejeune. Here are people buying, you know, Star Trek books. Talking about a really, really different environment.
Hence, she went ahead and set the book on Lejeune post-Gulf War, but pre-9/11. Simpson says she didn't want to get into the issue of terrorism. But nevertheless, she does bring up issues that were common to the military of 20 years ago as well as today, such as issues surrounding the integration of women into the military.
One of the, you might say, the suspects involved in this was a woman Marine officer. And I think she makes it clear that juggling is the same, whether it's a woman Marine or whether it is a, you know, a Home Depot executive of the home and your professional career, and maybe more demanding in the military because you aren't just gone for the weekend. You may be gone for a whole year at a time. There's that. A woman being able to maintain her personal integrity and yet still be able to assert herself, play a kind of game when they're already, the rules are sort of built in, and she's having to bend them a little, but at the same time, she doesn't want to bend them so much that she damages the organization.
But while BOQ touches on contemporary themes, at its heart, it's an old-fashioned closed-circle mystery. There's a body in the room, or in this case, under a dock, and a limited circle of people who might be just as happy the victim is dead rather than alive. And N.P. Simpson is fine with that. While any modern murder mystery might initially draw comparisons to contemporary fictional crime solvers like Kay Scarpetta or Alex Delaware, Simpson doesn't particularly want that association.
I don't much care for the grisly gore type novel that has been popular recently because I don't have to read 6 pages, you know, of a cell layer by cell layer description of a rape to grasp, you know, the seriousness of the event. There's something about it I just don't care for. I'm a Conan Doyle fanatic. I'm a Sherlock Holmes admirer. It's the step-by-step process of what's going on here and what is the conclusion is what's important to me. I'm really not interested in how much of a psychopath the killer was.
Simpson says she already has 2 more books featuring Fran Setliff in mind, the next to take place not on board Camp Lejeune but at Guantanamo Bay in the early 1990s. The gap between publishing BOQ and the next, probably not as long as the 20-year gap between nonfiction book number one and fiction book number one, though Simpson says she probably rewrote BOQ at least 6 times before it was ready to go. And the killer in version one wasn't the same as the killer who made the printed page. That might seem a little odd, but she says in this closed-circle type of mystery, everybody and anybody should make sense for the book to satisfy its reader.
I think I did try, and let's say there are 6 red herrings or 6 different people who might be plausible suspects. I think I had to write it in my mind as though each one were the actual perpetrator because for it to be credible to the reader, it would have to be credible to me. In other words, it couldn't be purely a red herring where I can remember, and actually I'm not sure Agatha Christie actually said this, but I think I read somewhere that she said a really good mystery, you should be able to go back to the beginning of the book and reread it and see early signs that this is the way it really happened. There should be clues from the very beginning. And if you don't see any clues until the last quarter of the book, then you're sort of jerking, well, of course, Agatha Christie didn't use the expression jerking around, but you're sort of playing with your reader.
N.P. Simpson is the author of BOQ, an NCIS Special Agent Fran Setliff novel. It's published by John F. Blair. I'm George Olson.
I'm Ari Shapiro. If you find NPR reliable and comforting, you're not alone. If your old car is a bit less than reliable, well, you're not alone either. Donate your car to us and turn it into the programs you love.
visit publicradioeast.org to link to our vehicle donation program, accepting all vehicles running or not, cars, trucks, boats, planes, motorcycles, RVs, and heavy farm equipment. And your donated vehicle can be picked up from almost anywhere in the country.
This week on American Roots, we'll remember the late singer-songwriter Jesse Winchester through his music and his own words. Then a visit to Rugby, Virginia for a close listen to sustainable guitars and ukuleles made by Jane and Wayne Henderson. I'm Nick Spitzer. Join me for American Roots from PRX.
American Roots this evening at 6 o'clock on all of the PRE Public Radio East stations.
This is Lisa Rayburn, horticulture agent with Onslow County Cooperative Extension, here with this week's edition of The Garden Journal. Nothing adds color and beauty to your patio or porch like a beautiful container garden. Don't be intimidated by the containers you see at the garden center. You can put your own combination together with your personal spin, and often for a whole lot less money. The first step is to select your container. You are only limited by your imagination. Choose a container that appeals to you. Just make sure it has adequate drainage. If you love a container that doesn't have drainage holes, use a power drill to add one or more holes to the bottom. Once you have your container, you'll want to fill it with a high-quality potting mix. If the potting mix contains a slow-release fertilizer, you're ready to go. If it does not, mix a slow-release formulation in before planting. Slow-release fertilizers provide nutrients over an extended period of time. Now comes the fun part. It's time to add your plants. The number of plants that you will need depends on the size of your container. A good rule of thumb is that 3 to 4 plants will fill a 10 to 12 inch planter, while 4 to 6 plants will be needed to fill a 14 to 16 inch planter. These planters will not look full all at once, but will start to fill out after several weeks of growth. Vigorous, sprawling plants, like petunias, will not require as many plants to fill a pot, while slow-growing, upright plants, like pansies, can be planted more closely together to make the pot appear more lush. You can fill your container with just one type of plant, or you can choose a variety of plants. If you decide to mix plants, a classic technique is to choose a thriller, a filler, and a spiller. The thriller is an upright plant with dramatic structure and foliage that you place in the center or back of the container. Fun thriller options include spikes, cordeline, dwarf cannas, dragon wing begonias, ornamental peppers, or sun coleus. For your filler, choose a more mounding plant that will fill in the center of the container. Fillers could include smaller coleus, mounding petunias, or geraniums. The spiller then cascades down the side of the pot, softening the edge of the container. Look for trailing forms of verbena, bicopa, or calipricoa. When mixing plants, you'll want to choose plants for their blooms, but also for the texture or color of their foliage. So some leaves may be large and leathery, others small and wispy. This adds interest and variety to the container. I like to combine plants on my cart when I'm at the garden center. I'll often put different plants next to each other and play with the combination of flowers, form, and foliage until I find a combination that appeals to me. This works well. Just make sure you choose plants that have the same growing preferences, sun versus shade, and moist versus dry soil conditions. Once you've selected your plants, arrange them in the container. Gently tease apart any overgrown root balls and work potting mix gently between the plants. Make sure that there's at least an inch of room between the surface of the potting mix and the top rim of the pot when you're done. Water gently to settle the potting mix around your plants, and then sit back and enjoy. In 2 or 3 weeks, your container will fill in and look just as lush and gorgeous as any from the garden center. With a little bit of pinching and deadheading, you can have a beautiful container garden all summer long.
The deadline of our year-long goal to fully fund Public Radio East is almost here. June 30th is the last day of this fiscal year, and the variety of programs you depend on are in the balance. Membership continues to be our single largest source of funding. Thank you if your annual membership contribution is current. But if you've never made a pledge before, decide what you'd like to contribute and make a pledge at publicradioeast.org.
Thanks for listening to the Downeast Journal. If you have questions, comments, or ideas for features, drop us a line at publicradioeast.org.